Well, Hank was 9, and Charlie was 4 when Kelly and I took them to Orlando. We'd gotten up before dawn, and we'd caught an early flight. And upon arriving in Florida, we rented a car and went straight to Disney World. And after a long day at the park, we headed over not too far away to the Nickelodeon Hotel, where we were staying for the night. And though it had become unseasonably cold, the boys wanted to swim, which we did. And then, exhausted, we returned to the room. And with the boys now in their bunk beds, we all expected a good night's rest. Instead, about 2 a.m., we heard a very loud, very ear-piercing sound. Now, let it be said, I'm giving you fair warning. Right now, you should probably cover your ears. I'm not kidding. Because it sounded something like this. Yes, the hotel's 120 decibel fire alarm had gone off. And Kelly and I got up. And Charlie, like you who didn't cover your ears, began to cry. But Hank, though the alarm continued, didn't stir at all. In the top bunk, no movement whatsoever. I climbed up and leaned up into his ear. Hank, we've got to go. The fire alarm is going off, as if you needed to say that. To which he nearly stretched and fluffed his pillow a little bit and turned over. Well, after a couple of tries, I began to maneuver him down from the top bunk, and I got him down to the bottom bunk, and with the alarm still blaring, set him up against the wall, and then I got dressed and got his coat. But when I returned, he had flopped over completely asleep again in the bottom bunk. I managed to get his coat on, and we, along with Kelly and Charlie and every other now nearly deaf occupant of the Nickelodeon Hotel, then stood out in the parking lot in the freezing cold for the next 15 minutes until we got the all clear and returned to the room and got the kids back in bed. But here's the most remarkable part of the story. When we all got up the next morning, we asked Hank what he thought of all the commotion, what he had thought about being so rudely awakened in the middle of the night by the loudest fire alarm of all time. And his response was, "What fire alarm?" That's all to say that it takes more to wake up some of us than it does others. And if sometimes it's hard to awaken our bodies, often it can be even harder to awaken our souls. But just as we have super loud fire alarms in hotels and we have ringing clocks and beeping phones next to our beds to awaken our bodies, we also have a remarkable tool available to awaken our souls. And it's an ancient technology, one found in the middle of our Bible, one we call the Psalms. So as we make our way through this profound book here this spring in this sermon series we've called Awake My Soul, what we're focused on today is how the Psalms work as a sort of field guide, as a sort of instruction or owner's manual that shows us how finite flesh and blood human beings like us can connect meaningfully in an actual relationship with an infinite and invisible God. And in trying to do exactly this morning, we're going to talk about three different psalms that introduce us to three different frequencies along which we can reliably and effectively come into contact, closer communion with God. So let's try this. Imagine a radio dial in front of you, maybe a screen with three different buttons that you can push. And the first setting, the first button you can push to connect more closely with God is this: emotion. Emotional honesty. The next setting on the dial, the next button or icon we can push to connect to God more closely let's think of as authenticity. Just being who you really are before God. And third, the third setting, this third icon, this third frequency we'll touch on today, we'll call wonder. Emotional honesty, authenticity, and wonder. Those are the three frequencies the psalmist uses to awaken us, to stir us, to move us closer in relationship to God. So let's start with honesty. Emotional honesty. Was a teenager, I was pretty truthful with my parents most of the time. However, my record was not flawless. When I was around 15 years old, one weekend, I recall we had some sort of family event going on Saturday evening. And earlier in the day, I told my mother I was going over to study with a group of friends. But I'd be back by 4 or so, plenty of time to get ready and go to the event. But see, here's the thing. I didn't actually go over to my friends to study. Instead, we all went to Astroworld, which was great. We had a great time until later, as it got closer and closer to 4 p.m., I realized I was going to have to call home. So I found a payphone in the park. We didn't have cell phones back then. And I'm not proud of this, but I decided, rather than coming clean, I decided to double down on this studying with my friends story. And I'm still not sure whether it was something in my voice, or more likely the unmistakable roar of the Texas Cyclone roller coaster in the background, but my mother clearly knew I was lying. And full of her characteristic but unwarranted motherly grace, she said only this: "Greg, your nose is growing." We all know the story of Pinocchio, the adventurous wooden puppet remembered for having two main qualities. First, he dreams of becoming a real boy. And second, when he lies, his nose starts to grow. And Pinocchio, you know, still appears in our culture an awful lot. You see him in commercials sometimes. For instance, the story's character also is what the Washington Post fact-checkers use to rate the truthfulness of the statements of our nation's politicians. They get 1, 2, 3, or 4 Pinocchios depending upon their honesty or lack thereof. Well, employing this scale, it seems the first thing that the psalmist is telling us is that if we want to have a closer relationship, if we want to be in closer communion with God, what we need more than anything else is a zero Pinocchio policy. You know, if you read just a few chapters into the Psalms, into this book, you quickly detect we're given a permission structure to do just this. The psalmist tells us that whatever we're feeling, anxiety, joy, anger, whatever it is, we need to up our honesty game and express to God exactly what we're feeling. For instance, if the number of Americans reporting anxiety symptoms has tripled since before the pandemic, and it has, it may be the case that our collective nose might be growing if in our relationship with God we're not using emotionally honest, resonant, soul-awakening words like these from Psalm 6, verses 2 through 9. Listen. "Mercy, Lord, for I am faint. Heal me, for my bones are in agony. My soul is in deep anguish. How long, Lord, how long? Turn, Lord, and deliver me. Save me because of your unfailing love. I'm worn out from my groaning. All night long I flood my bed with weeping. I drench my couch with tears. My eyes grow weak with sorrow. They fail because of all my foes. Away from me, all you who do evil, for the Lord has heard my weeping. The Lord has heard my cry for mercy. The Lord accepts my prayers." This is the word of the Lord. Do you hear the pain? Do you hear that anxiety, the emotional honesty inside those words? They make it clear that the headline for us, if we want to awaken and more fully connect with an invisible and eternal God, is this: no Pinocchios. Second, authenticity. Authenticity. What the Psalms tell us is that human beings connect with the divine best when we come to God not so much as the people we want to be or the people we know we ought to be, but simply as the people that we really are, unfiltered, unedited, and unplugged. I don't know a whole lot about NASCAR, but whenever I do tune in to watch a race on television, there's usually some technical talk about something called a restrictor plate. A restrictor plate, or air restrictor, is a device installed at the intake of the engine to limit its power. That is, as fast as stock cars go, they could go even faster if they took these things off. They took these restrictor plates off. And I think sometimes we pray with a restrictor plate on. But the psalmist tells us not to do this. If you'd like some evidence of this, well, ladies and gentlemen, start your engines, because this is the 109th psalm. It's known as the cursing psalm. And fair warning, this guy is mad. He's upset like a Winston Cup racer who's been put into the wall by a rival racer. It's Psalm 109, verses 6 through 15. Send the evil one to accuse my accusing judge. Dispatch Satan to prosecute him. When he's judged, let the verdict be guilty. And when he prays, let his prayer turn to sin. Give him a short life. Give his job to somebody else. Make orphans of his children. Dress his wife in widow's weeds. Turn his children into beggars, begging in the street like urchins, evicted from their homes, homeless. May the bank foreclose and wipe them out. Strangers like vultures plunder all his wealth. May there be no one around to help him out, no one willing to give his orphans a break. See, some of you like turning in the, is this really in the Bible? Chop down his family tree so that nobody even remembers his name. It goes on. Erect a memorial to the sin of his father. Make sure his mother's name is there too. Their sins recorded forever before God while they themselves are sunk into oblivion. It's hard even to try to say this is the word of the Lord after that, isn't it? And while as Christians we have to read this in light of the gospel and the Sermon on the Mount and not hate and not act against others in contempt and in vengeance, Psalm 109, this cursing psalm, is telling us in the context of how we communicate with God, if we're angry, we need to authentically express our anger. Perhaps the hidden or implied message and lesson in this psalm is to acknowledge hatred and contempt is the first step to changing them. Maybe a cry for vengeance is an appeal to God for help in clearing out that poison. But the bottom line with regard to this strange psalm seems to be is that we're being instructed to bring to our relationship with God not some curated social media version of ourselves, not some well-polished Madison Avenue advertisement for ourselves, but just ourselves, authentic, human, and as we really are. Wonder. Finally, the psalmist tells us that if we want to hear God's voice clearly, we need to steep ourselves in wonder and widen the range of our imagination. Psalm 8 is where we find a good example of this frequency. Psalm 8, the frequency of wonder. Find that on the dial. Listen, I'll read from verse 1 and 3 through 5 and 9 of Psalm 8. Lord, Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You've set your glory in heavens. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars you've set in place. What is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you pay them heed. You've made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and with honor. Lord, Lord, how majestic is thy name in all the earth. Now this is the word of the Lord. For this psalm takes us out under the night sky to consider a God responsible for the terrifying vastness of the universe, but also a God who's mindful of us, generous, beneficent, personal, a God who sees us as a part of the heavenly family, calibrated just a little bit lower than the angels themselves. And yet perhaps the most remarkable part of this psalm is not the wondrous picture of a big creator God or the wondrous picture of an intimate personal God, but that it's pointing us to a single super wondrous picture of a God both vast and intimate, big and small, all-knowing and all-caring, all at the same time. You know, we often hear people of goodwill say in good faith, it's delusional and self-absorbed to think that a universe-creating God would or could take any sort of detailed interest in the lives of insignificant little beings on an insignificant little rock in the infinitude of space. But here's the thing. Simply that we have a hard time imagining it reveals not that God can't do both, but only that our minds tend to be incapable of retaining the ideas of the super big and the super small and personal at the same time. And what this psalm is asking of us is to expand the range of our imagination to an even loftier picture of God, a God that does both quite easily. That is, to dial into this frequency of awe and wonder sufficient to hold both pictures of God in our heads, in our minds at the same time. That the one who created the canopy of stars above, and the one that is not merely mindful of us, but so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son for us, is one and the same. A picture that leads us to join in the psalmist's words, Lord, how majestic is thy name in all the earth. So there they are, the three frequencies, the three icons, the three settings, the three buttons, the three psalms waking us up and putting on offer to us an intimate communion and relationship with God if we're simply willing to bring emotional honesty to the table. No Pinocchios. Then stop acting like who we think we ought to be and simply approach God as who we really are. And finally, to consider creation and the very miracle of our existence with all the wonder and awe that it deserves. You know, it's sometimes said that we only use 10% of our brains. Maybe that's the case with our souls as well. And if that's what this remarkable book is trying to change within our souls, is trying to awaken us to,